This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Well, we're into serious electoral season here. We've just had a primary election, and we want to talk about the implication of that for our politics heading into the fall. Our guests are Emily Ryan with Copper State Consulting, Doug Cole with Arizona High Ground, and a few minutes from now, we will also bring in Mike Noble from OH Predictive. Here's the background. The Republicans in the Arizona State Legislature have controlled everything for decades. And the significance of that can't be understated. If you have even a single vote majority in the legislature, as, for example, the Republicans currently do in the House, it's 31-29. What that means is on almost every issue, the Republicans caucus and they try to whip their people in line and they say, we need to hang together because if we hang together, we control everything and the 29 Democrats become irrelevant. Okay. So 31-29 is not terribly different from 32-28, except in a rare case when there's a defection. In the Senate, it's 17-13 Republican. If the Democrats can pick up, for example, two seats in the Senate, then it's 15-15. The Republicans cannot control everything, and the Democrats get a full seat at the table. And I think that's the biggest thing. Winning one, because there's a Republican governor, the question is now, do the Democrats get in the game? Do they get in the game? Requires them to be at least tied in at least one branch of the legislature. And that's what we're going to start out talking about. And we're going to start out with the Senate. It is 17-13 Democrat. That means that the Democrats, to get in the game, need to pick up two seats. Doug Cole, I'll go to you first. Where do you think their biggest prospects are for doing that?
Well, thanks, Mike, for having me on. It's been quite the election week, so we got a lot to talk about today. I think the biggest opportunities to pick up those two seats that you were just discussing would be in Legislative District 6, which is what we call the Mountain District. That goes from Flagstaff all the way over to Holbrook, down to Snowflake and, you know, Sholo Pinetop Lakeside area, and also includes Payson. I think the biggest pickup there probably will be the contest between Wendy Rogers, who's been a longtime perennial candidate who beat the incumbent, Sylvia Allen, by roughly 60-40. It was quite a
change for her, because she's you said perennial candidate, that was, I believe that was perennial losing candidate.
I think she's run for office in every cycle since 2008 or 2010.
Started with that one, I want to move for just a second to Emily. Sure. Because when Emily was on the show on election night, she made a comment that I circled and I said, well, that's provocative. Emily, you made the comment that you thought that Wendy Rogers' victory over Sylvia Allen augmented the day. You thought that she was the weakest possible candidate for the Republicans to put forth in November. And I'm wondering why.
You know, I knew I was going to have to relive those words. You touched on it earlier, talking about her being a perennial losing candidate. You know, Wendy Rogers has, since 2010, hopscotched district to district all over the state of Arizona, losing races. You don't see a lot of her in person, some really dated campaign material. You know, she really delivered a sound beating to Sylvia Allen. She had a congressional war chest that she was able to dump in to this primary. But she's a weak candidate. She's got a big losing record, and she would not be my preference to run in the general to try to hold that seat. I think that's perhaps one of the most vulnerable seats in the Senate.
It's interesting, because I was surprised. Not only did I pick that up as a provocative statement, but I was kind of surprised because I always saw Sylvia Allen is out there on kind of the far right flank, and that she would be the one that it would be difficult for moderate Republicans to vote for. And so without knowing a whole lot about that district, my gut reaction was just the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, I could see where you would gather that. I guess in a presidential election year, looking for strong Republican turnout to carry it. You know, Wendy Rogers has just been such a weak candidate, and I don't know anyone that's actually met her in person. It's strange. She runs for everything all over, but she doesn't really interact a lot. So yeah. I guess I was coming at it from more of a very weak campaign or perspective.
Well, as you said, she's got money. Well, later on, Mike can tell us whether she spent it all in the primary or whether she's got any left. Back to Doug, other Senate opportunities. I assume LD-28 is going to be high on that list.
Well, yeah. But if I just can quickly say why Wendy, we just talked about why Wendy is a weak candidate.
Yeah.
We also need to mention why the Democrats a strong candidate. Remember back in 2018, Sylvia barely defeated her by only 1,700 votes.
Good point.
Felicia French, who is a combat veteran nurse, garnered nearly 20,000 votes on Tuesday. And Wendy Rogers garnered, when she beat Sylvia, garnered 15,000 votes. So they've got a good candidate who's already, you know, who's pretty well seasoned. So I wanted to add that to the discussion.
Okay. LD-28 is a rematch. Christine Marsh, Democrat, former Teacher of the Year, against Senator Kate Brophy McGee, who is not only really a fixture in the legislature, she is one of a dwindling number of Republicans who will once in a while walk across the aisle to cooperate. But very that's swing district. Man.
That's a very swing district. Remember, Senator Kate Brophy McGee back in 2018 only won that match by 267 votes against Christine Marsh.
Yep.
Now, if you look at the raw numbers from Tuesday, Christine Marsh got 25,000 Democratic and independent votes that voted for her. And Kate Brophy McGee got 20,535 Republican or independent votes.
I noticed that too. How predictive is that historically, getting more votes in the primary?
It's not, because the Democrats were more motivated. They had a lot more contested races. They were a lot more motivated here in the primary. And the demographics and the voter model is going to change a bit moving into November. But we cannot discount the enthusiasm of the Democrat voters and the efforts that are being made by the party to turn their voters out.
I agree, Doug. I agree. I think Doug's making a good point there, because, you know, what makes us also nervous about District 28 is that Dem turnout in early returns, the Republican ground that was given up in the primary is kind of unprecedented, Democratic registration being up, and independents. 28 is a strong independent district, and you've got independents that were requesting Dem ballots this year. Those are all nerve-wracking signs.
We're running out of time for this segment. What else you got in the way of Republican vulnerabilities in the Senate?
I would watch, Mike, I would also keep an eye on LD-8, which is down in central Arizona, my Pinal County, where I grew up. That's Coolidge, Casa Grande, Florence, down in that area. Represented right now by Senator Frank Pratt, who was termed out. He's going to the House. He's running for the House. That would be Speaker Pro Tem T.J. Shope, which is a big name in central Arizona, a longtime family down there. He's running against former Senator Barbara McGuire. I would watch that. Likely Republican, by my estimation.
Let me flip to the other side. Is there anything where it is currently Democrat in the Senate that the Democrats will have to watch their flank that they might lose?
Not in my estimation. Emily, what do you think?
No, I don't see any opportunities to pick up an extra Republican seat in the Senate.
Okay, good enough. So it's all on the what if anything do the Democrats gain in the Senate seems to be the question. We will be back and we'll talk about the Arizona State Legislative House when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, in light of our recent primary, we are discussing the possibility that to somebody who's been asleep for a few years would seem wildly speculative, but what is the possibility that the Democrats will gain at least a 50-50 split in the Arizona legislature? We just got through talking about the Senate. Now we're going to talk about the House. Emily Ryan, what would you look at as the top Democratic target in the House?
You know, I think the House will almost assuredly go Democratic. They've only got to pick up two seats to make that happen.
Wow.
And they've got...
Okay, we'll quote you on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've got maybe five opportunities to pick up those two seats. I think Jay Lawrence's district, 23, is a vulnerable target.
Even though that's a very Republican district. Now, Jay Lawrence is one of two incumbents that appears to be on his way to a defeat. There's some vote counting left, but at last count, he's down by 1,000 votes. So, I'm sorry, 600 votes. 600 votes now would have been a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And, you know, so then we don't have an incumbent Republican running for that seat. You'll have an unknown name, and it's going to come down to turnout. You know, it's certainly one that's vulnerable. And with the Democratic spending that's going to be happening in the state of Arizona all over the place, that can impact any of these targets. I think District 8, where Doug grew up, Pinal County, I think that's a target. We've had Cook and Pratt, and you know, that race is too close to call right now as well. Anthony Kern in District 20 is another very vulnerable seat that I think Democrats are going to shoot at.
That's what we call a single shot candidate. There's, I believe, one Democrat running for the two seats.
So Judy Schweibert,
So in other words, somebody who's sort of a moderate Republican could say, well, I'll vote for one of the two Republicans and I'll vote for the one Democrat.
Somebody could say that, and I think they'll dump a lot of money. The fact that they're single-shotting or running one Democratic candidate in that district tells you they're being strategic and smart about their playbook. They're not cannibalizing their own voter population.
Because in a district like that, it's going to be almost impossible to win both.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they're playing it really smart and strategic. Brenda Barton's seat in District 6, I think, is vulnerable. And I think Kevin Payne's District 21, there's some vulnerability there because, you know, we're going to have Mr. Payne and then sort of an unknown non-incumbent running with him.
Doug, your comment on those, that's a big statement Emily made in the beginning. She thinks it's odds on Democratic takeover of the House. Do you buy that?
I we're either going to be split or Democrat as things look here in the first week of August right now. But you know, we have 90 days to go. That's an eternity in politics. But I want to add to the list that, you know, back to District 6 up on the mountain, Flagstaff, you know, Sholo Payson, Snowflake. Bob Thorpe is running for the supervisor in Coconino County. He was termed out, so we have an open seat up there. Brenda Barton is I want to talk a bit more about it. You brought it up, Emily, but you have on the Democrat side, you have Coral Evans, who's the current Flagstaff mayor, very popular. And you also have Art Babbitt, who's a longtime Coconino County supervisor, running as an independent. So you have two strong candidates that are non-Republicans running up there. So
Is that from the Babbitt family?
No, he has it. It's OT on the end, not IT.
It's just a great name.
Yeah. It's not a bad confusion to have up there.
Right. But we've been talking about Republicans playing defense, which is normally the case in this election coming forward. We do have one race that the Democrats, I feel, in a House seat, they're going to be playing defense. And Republicans can play offense. That's in Legislative District 4, which is Yuma, the Far West Valley, Buckeye, and a little bit reaches into West Tucson. And Representative Keaton, who serves with Charlene Fernandez, she only garnered nearly 7,000 votes, whereas Charlene Fernandez, the minority leader from Yuma, garnered 10,000 votes, 3,000 vote difference. The Republicans have been strategic in that district, and they are running a single candidate named Joel John from a longtime family in Buckeye, and he garnered 8,300 votes. So I look to that as a pickup for Republican pickup. So that's why it may be a 30-30 House, There's a lot of ground to cover between now and in November, but that would be the one Republican pickup out of both the House and Senate that I would be looking at this point.
Well, interesting conclusions I draw from this. My setup on this was the interesting threshold questions for the Democrats are, can they get to 50-50 in either House? And because of the House rather than the Senate, I think you're both saying odds on that's going to happen. Maybe more, but that at a minimum seems to be the baseline right now. I've got one other thing that I want to make. You got to give me in 15, 20 seconds. Heather Carter looks like she's losing her seat to she was one of the few people who crossed the aisle along with Kate Brophy-McGee. Looks like she's on her way out. Less of a middle ground in the legislature, it would seem to me.
Definitely. It's going to be very polarized. I think anytime you have a power swap like that, people really sort of run to their caucus corners and try to hold their ground.
And that's just not on the Republican side. The Democrats have also have been having a little retrospective analysis of the progressive wing and the moderate wing of that party also.
Very true.
Okay, we will return with up front will be Mike Noble. Talk about the overall climate and some global factors operating within the state. And then the following section, we will go and discuss the national offices when we return in just a second in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, this is a postmortem on the Arizona primary, but mostly looking forward to what the implications of that is for November. We've been talking to Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting and Doug Cole of Arizona High Ground, but with us also is Mike Noble from OH Predictive. They have done a lot of polling and particularly want to talk to him, give you the floor, Mike, to talk about what the work you have done tells us about the current climate in the state of Arizona.
100%. Thank you so much, Mike, for having me on. It's great to be with such an all-star cast you put together with Doug and Emily. I have a lot of respect for them. And it's interesting looking at what we've been trending. We've been actually tracking these presidential elections here in Arizona since February of 2019. We've actually done eight polls, and the ninth one is actually will be releasing next week. But the trends that we're currently seeing is that, you know, in Arizona right now, like, let's look at the generic congressional ballot. Right now, Democrats actually have a +2 advantage over Republicans. Frankly, I don't think I'd see that in my time here in Arizona. And it just shows that 2020, how much has shifted since President Trump has been elected, has moved Arizona into a battleground state status. That is mind-blowing. Think about it. Arizona is right up there with Florida and Pennsylvania now, and one of the key tipping point states that is ultimately going to decide who's going to sit in the White House. And
I've run simulations with lots of very, very plausible patterns of state. Now, all of these assume that Donald Trump improves a little bit, because right now he would lose all of the swing states and it's not even close. But if you take Donald Trump up nationally from being -10 to maybe being -5, there are some very plausible scenarios where the whole presidency comes down to Arizona.
100%. And so what's interesting about President Trump, so look at his job approval rating. For example, at the beginning of this election cycle in February of 19, he was actually above water by 5 points. 52% approved of the job he was doing. 47% of Arizona likely voters disapproved. And it was interesting, right, in about March of 2020, the reason why March is important, that was just before the stay-at-home order and the coronavirus really impacted Arizona. At that point in time, Trump was only -2 in job approval, 50 to 48. But now, since COVID hit, it has it negatively impacted his numbers with Arizona voters. Currently, he's at 53% that disapprove of him compared to 46% right now. So he's -7 when it comes to Arizona. So how do Arizona feel he's handled the virus? Probably not as well as he should, says the numbers.
And not all that different from what he is now. I mean, it's pretty hard to argue with facts here. with, you know, 160,000 dead. And if you do look at any objective comparison of the U.S. to almost any other country on the face of the earth, it's not a pretty picture.
100%. And what's also very interesting, so now we look at the head-to-head matchup between Trump and Biden. And what's so interesting of the nine polls we've done, on Trump's best day, he gets 46% of the vote. On his worst day, he got 43% of the vote. And so you look at, he has a very small margin between his ceiling and his floor, whereas Joe Biden, for the last 4 or 5 months, has been sitting anywhere from 49% to 52% support. So the question is, how is Donald Trump going to get to that 50+1? And currently, Biden has a 5-point advantage over the president, who carried Arizona by 3.5 points back in 2016.
I draw an inference from that, and that is the people who want to see some hope for Trump can look to, oh, Dukakis was up by 16 points and he got clobbered. But those numbers were all over the map. Donald Trump, to take the national figures and not the individual polls, but the averages, has, since his first year in office, around the end of his first year in office, in other words, the last 3 years, he has varied only from 39% at his low to 45% at his high. He's been in a 6-point range. Now, as you know, there's an individual poll here and there that can go above or below, but I'm talking about the daily averages. And that is the narrowest, and nobody's even close. That is the narrowest range that any president has offered. I mean, George H.W. Bush, he got over 90% at the edge of the Gulf War. And then he ended up below water. I mean, Trump is, the opinions are fixed, you know, that they're just varying by the slightest amount. And so the head-to-head with Biden, Joe Biden is a known commodity as well. It's not like picking somebody, Jimmy Carter, out of the blue, that the numbers could go all over creation because you don't know who he is. And as you find out, you either like him more or less. Trump, everybody has an opinion about. And Biden has been around for 40 years. If you don't have a fixation on what you think of Biden, you've been asleep. So I look at that and say, I don't see a whole lot of prospects for big change.
And it's interesting that there's actually two bright spots for Trump. One was that he actually held about a 10 or 12 point edge in voter enthusiasm. His supporters were more excited than Joe Biden's supporters. However, due to COVID in polling, it has shown that essentially they're now tied in enthusiasm, and that essentially Trump squandered one of his two advantages. His other second advantage is currently the money aspect. I mean, Trump he's raised over $350 million, which is insane, and compared to the $275 million roughly by Joe Biden. So he has a cash advantage, is basically the last advantage he currently holds. But Biden actually outraised Trump in the month of June. Biden's campaign raised $63 million compared to Trump's $55 million.
I'll ask this question to Doug, because you've run campaigns. I've always, my observation on money is this: one guy has money, the other has none. Money beats no money. But at some point, when everybody has a lot of money, who has a little bit more doesn't matter a whole lot.
Yeah, the noise just becomes overwhelming. It's just it just consumes everybody. And people really start to tune out. But one of the interesting factors, if I can ask Mr. Noble, how underperformed do you think is Trump with the voters that won't respond honestly to pollsters as we saw back in 2018? How big of an effect do you think that is right now?
Well, I think the effect, there's been a lot of rhetoric or talk about some of these hidden voters and things of that nature. And frankly, I'm not seeing it in the numbers. And so, for example, like when we do these polls, when the makeup of your sample, so that composition, to make sure it's reflective of the electorate, not only each time we do it, we randomize the list every time. So every time it's a lottery, it goes through. And again, we've had plenty of touch points. If we were polling here and there, and we're messing around with our methodology or our sample makeup, I mean, we're comparing apples to apples each time. And as things are going or trending, and frankly, I don't see it. And one of the key stats, so why they missed it in 2016, for example, in the polling, and they got a lot of flack for it, was because of that. It really came down to two or three key states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I mean, that's really
one. And I'll comment on that. And what happened was they were underpolled at the end because they were assumed to be safely in the Democratic column. That was the mistake. It was last term trends in the upper Midwest, which was running counter to the rest of the country. And polling, you know, you only poll where people pay you to do it. The networks weren't paying for polling. They didn't want to see a poll in Michigan because everybody knew that Hillary was going to win. They wanted to see polls in Georgia and Arizona and all kinds of places that looked like a stretch for her at the time and turned out to be a stretch for her, because she didn't expand at all. She contracted. But, you know, that is a persistent myth of shy Trump voters, been studied. American Association for Public Opinion Research did a major study of that. And there were a number of things that went wrong, mainly neglecting late polling in those upper Midwest states. But shy Trump voters wasn't one of them.
And Mike hit the nail on the head, is that, you know, it's interesting. For example, let's say I run a poll, randomized. I take the entire voter list, randomize it up, so everyone should technically have an equal chance of answering. And it's interesting, when you look at education level, when they self-identify, people that have a high school degree or less, who are very strong pro-Trump, that we saw in the election, are significantly undersampled. I mean, you're going to get 9% when the number should be closer to 18 or 20. But also, when you look at on the other end of the spectrum, postgraduate people with a higher than a bachelor's degree, is that they significantly respond to surveys more than high school or less folks. I mean,
so the lesson in 2016 is you have to wait for those folks. And it's like, to go back in a historical context, you didn't have to wait for it because it wasn't that strongly correlated before 2016. History of polling, 1932, Franklin Roosevelt. Prior to that, you didn't worry about looking at social class as a variable because it wasn't correlated with voting. Well, in 1932, a big thing happened, the Depression. And starting in 36, it was correlated heavily. And that was the famous Literary Digest, which had 3 million respondents and got it absolutely, totally wrong. We will return. We will talk about federal offices, particularly a focus on congressional seats. And is there any prospect for any of the current incumbents from the state of Arizona delegation to lose their seats when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank?
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are going to talk about, as promised, federal offices, starting with Congress. And there is one seat that just jumps out at you. That is Congressional District 6 background. That is normally a completely safe Republican district by 10 points, which is, in any normal state of affairs, enough to make a district very, very safe. Congressman Swikert is the incumbent. He was hit with very serious ethics charges, which he admitted to this past week. He is in the process of being formally reprimanded by the House and will pay a $50,000 fine. My other understanding about this is that he has had to use almost his entire campaign war chest to pay legal fees for this. So put all those things together, and what I think most of us would agree is a pretty good Democratic year, and all of a sudden we have the makings of a competitive run in CD6. The Democratic nominee is Hiral Tepper-Ninny, who won a somewhat contested race against Anita Malik, who had been a prior nominee. Now, Tepper-Ninny had run in the West Side, Debbie Lesko's district, which is a plus 25% district. She got within 5% in the special election, within 10% in the general. In other words, she beat the spread by 15 to 20 points. That's a really good candidate. So,
hey, Mike, can I yes. jump in here and tell your listeners where CD6 is? That's Scottsdale, Fountain Hills, Cave Creek, and Carefree. So that's a very, very, very historically Republican affluent district.
But it is upper educated Republican district, the kind of folks who a lot of whom have some trouble with Donald Trump. They are not social conservative. And correct me if you think I got it wrong. They're not social conservatives. They just want to pay less taxes. What we'd call economics conservatives.
I would agree with that analysis.
Yeah.
And Schweikert was a pretty good fit for that district. That's who he was.
Schweikert was a great fit for that district because, you know, Schweikert has maintained his whole long political career as a watch the bottom line fiscal budget hawk kind of guy. And that makes it particularly tough when he has to admit to 11 counts in a congressional ethics investigation that all focus around misappropriating campaign funds and money for, you know, $350 for babysitters, and his initial stall tactics and chalking that up to accounting errors. You don't get to be the wonky numbers guy and make accounting errors and say, oh, it's a simple, you know, I can make accounting errors. I'm horrible at math. Everyone knows that. David Schweikert can't get away with that. He can't have it both ways. You take that, you add in that Carol Tipperneni is a great candidate. She's warm, engaging. When you meet her, she's a doctor in a global pandemic. It's just the making of, get used to saying, Congresswoman Tipperneni.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's strong.
Yeah. And remember, to Emily's point, David was the county treasurer. And when he was the House majority whip back when I was on House staff back in the 90s, I mean, he was the budget guy, you know. In Congress, he's been the deficit hawk, you know, on the Ways and Means Committee. I mean, he is the numbers guy, and all this stuff is on numbers.
100%. And there's a couple of things, if you guys don't mind jumping in, is that there's three main factors, because this district is a solidly Republican district. It should not, I think it won for Trump for by about 20 points. And so you look at this district, how in the world is the most competitive race in Arizona, currently Arizona's sixth district? There's three main factors. First one is money. When you look at just total amount raised, Tipperneni has a 2-to-1 total raise advantage. She's raised $2.4 million. Schweikert's raised $1.3 million. But it's not so much about raise, because how much money do they have left over? So now we look at their cash on hand. Schweikert has about $237,000 cash on hand. And then Tipperneni has $1.7 million. That's a 7-to-1 advantage for Tipperneni. And also the last key factor on the money, Schweikert's burn rate. So how fast is he going through that money he's raising? He's at 85% compared to Tipperneni is only at 35%.
And that's just their money, because we're going to get DCCC money in on this deal because they see blood in the water. And as we discussed in the first segment, that's going to have down ballot implications.
You used a technical term there. I just want to make sure. DCCC is Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. National Democrats smelling blood in the water.
Yeah, exactly. And to Mike's point, both Mikes, you know, you've got an 85% burn rate. That's mostly on his legal fees, which, you know, Dr. O'Neill brought up. He didn't have a primary, you know, so he's in big trouble any way you look at it.
And the last two main factors. So it's interesting, even with that one, that probably I don't think still would make it competitive. But based on the other two big factors, which is secondly, he has a decent suburban contingent. We saw a decent shift in that district in the midterms of folks that were loyal to Trump, but then voted cinema. And then also the last thing is the ethics. And I think, honestly, if you didn't have one of those three in there, it may not be competitive, but based on those three factors that have basically played in, it's currently the most competitive seat in Arizona, which is crazy, but it also sums up 2020, the year of murder hornets and a 100-year pandemic and all these other ridiculous things we've seen. It just sums up how is CD6 the most competitive race? Well, that is why.
Let me summarize all that. I think it comes to the perfect storm. We've got only a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you, there's 8 other congressional seats held by incumbents. Does anybody want to nominate any one of those seats as being where an incumbent is being threatened on either party?
No,
they're all safe.
Okay. We got agreement on that. We've got one race. Okay, one last thing here. Senate race. Martha McSally. She is down by a bunch. Can she overcome it?
You know, what's interesting is that I think McSally is very much defined. I mean, so look at the 2018 election against Sinema, is that when you look at, her race and the amount of money spent. So not only was she outspent by Sinema, but also when it comes to those precincts Trump carried that took him to victory here in Arizona, much of those precincts basically went for, Sinema. And it was interesting that, you know, of the 1,459 voter precincts in Arizona, there's actually only about 120 or so, they're actually really the persuadable. So about 8% roughly of the electorate, because we're so hyper polarized, and they absolutely went away. And so since it was so much, it was the most money spent ever on a race in Arizona, in the history of Arizona, over $100 million spent on the contest. It was actually the fourth most expensive.
Okay, I'm going to give you 10 seconds each. That's all. Give me your call, President and Senate in Arizona. Mike, you first.
To call it?
No explanation, just your call. Best guess.
President will be separated by a point or so, one or two. It's going to be incredibly close in Senate. I think currently slight edge to Mark Kelly.
Doug?
I hate to be boring, but I agree with Mr. Noble.
All right.
Yeah, here, first week of August.
And you don't want to, okay, the president's close. If you had guns to your head, who's going to win?
Right now, I would give Biden by a half point.
Okay, Emily.
Yeah, based on today, I'd say Biden-Kelly.
Wow. Extraordinary predictions from three fundamentally Republican consultants, I will point out, painting a bleak picture for the status of the Republican Party in the state. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week in the Think Tank.
Thanks.
Thank you.